It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at what's going on in Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer.
First, we're zeroing in on a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. Justices are debating whether or not for-profit businesses who object to contraception for religious reasons should have to cover it under the new health care law.
The case is centered in part around craft store Hobby Lobby, whose owners say they want to follow biblical principles while operating in a secular marketplace. Experts say the political implications of this ruling could be a big deal, especially important for President Obama's health care law.
Political scientist Kimmy King is with us to explain what's going on with the case so far. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back to Central Time.
Good morning. Afternoon. Sorry, how are you? It's a long day.
One or the other, right? Well, let's start with the basics. Can you summarize the case for us? What's it about?
Yeah. Where this came from is, you know, the Supreme Court has previously ruled that Congress did have the authority to pass the Affordable Care Act. And that was already a contentious decision that had been 5-4 back in 2012. And that just simply examined whether or not Congress had the power to do this. And the court held there that, yes, in fact, they do. They left open the issue of how it is applied in a variety of different circumstances. And be ready, because this is probably just going to be the first of many cases that tries to litigate over it. In essence, what has gone on is you have private companies, one Conestoga Wood, another AutoCam, which is an auto and medical manufacturer, and then Hobby Lobby, which is the one that everybody knows about, which have challenged the Affordable Care Act and the requirement that they as employers provide health care that includes birth control, which they consider to be abortion-related. And so they are challenging, in essence, claiming that their religious freedom is burdened because they do not want to be paying for health care insurance, which could, in essence, terminate life, like intrauterine devices. And so in the Third Circuit, Conestoga Wood, and in the Sixth Circuit, AutoCam, had been successful in saying, we're sorry, private companies, you may say it violates your religious freedom because you don't want to pay for this funding because you as the employer have religious beliefs that are pro-life. But in the Tenth Circuit, Hobby Lobby won, and the Tenth Circuit said that this did burden their religious beliefs and that government had not shown that it had a compelling government interest in requiring private employers pay for this kind of birth control. And that's why we're here.
And this has been, as you summarized, it's bounced around the circuit courts, and it seems to be right now dividing along partisan lines, with Justice Anthony Kennedy probably looking to be the deciding vote. Can you sort of summarize the arguments that we've been hearing so far?
Sure. So, and Kennedy is the one that everybody's watching, and everyone is pinning on him. And I will remind everyone that when the Affordable Care Act was being challenged, everybody was looking at Kennedy as being the swing voter. And then as it turned out, it was Chief Justice John Roberts, which cast the deciding vote to uphold the affordable health care under the taxing and spending clause. So all the political pundits may have it wrong. But here's in essence what the case boils down to. The question is, how do the standards apply for religious freedom? And do private corporations, are they protected by the same freedom of religion principles that individuals are protected by? There have been a series of decisions going back in time where the court has looked at different things, not only just religious freedom, but how the states might limit religious freedom. Are corporations considered to be persons within the meaning of the Constitution? Can the federal government mandate certain kinds of programs that might not otherwise be acceptable by the general population? And so that's why this case is so interesting to so many people, because it pulls on a wide-ranging set of case law and different legal principles to look at whether or not corporations can have religious beliefs and can they avoid being subject to regulations because of those religious beliefs.
And some of the justices questioning the lawyers for the corporations saying, well, how does a corporation express religious belief? And, you know, there are echoes, as you said, of Citizens United going back to 2010, that controversial Supreme Court ruling that corporations can be, in effect, people. What's at stake here with the answer to these questions?
Yeah, so in the case of Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission, there had been a long line of history that had said that corporations have speech. It's easier to make the argument that corporations have speech. It's not so easy to say, well, how do corporations, do they pray? Do they attend religious worship? Isn't something like religion inherently fundamental? And Citizens United may be distinguishing because it looks at that issue of participating in the political process. And so people are saying that Kennedy may draw a distinction there because, remember, he said corporations were individual, you know, had that ability to express themselves. But here's the difficult thing. Kennedy, going back in time, also signed, he was the author of a decision in City of Bernie versus Flores. There, the Supreme Court slapped Congress back when Congress tried to pass the Religious Freedom Restoration Act to protect religious freedom. There, Kennedy said that the Supreme Court decides what the standards are, and that, here's the touchstone for your listeners, what the court is in essence looking at under religious freedom is whenever government looks to place a substantial burden on your religious freedom, it has to show a compelling government interest. So corporations have to show how they are substantially burdened in their religious freedom and how, even if that's the case, what is government's compelling interest? Because government can still burden you if they have a compelling interest. So is health care a compelling interest? Is it a burden on religious freedom? Those are the kinds of issues that the justices are going to be, you know, arguing about as they decide this case.
And something else that may come into play in this is how is that question dealt with in organizations like churches and religious nonprofit groups? How will that play in?
Well, certainly, I mean, so some, you know, pundits are saying that Kennedy's going to try to find a real narrow ruling, because if they rule in favor of the three private plaintiffs, of the private corporations, you open up a Pandora's box. I'm a Christian Scientist, and I don't want to pay for vaccines. I don't want to, you know, another one would say, I don't want to pay for Social Security because I think that that's a public handout. And the Bible says, you know, you can see the various kinds of claims that will and challenges that will be made against the Affordable Care Act and indeed other federal laws should they rule that way. At the same time, the Obama administration has allowed nonprofit groups and other churches and, you know, like Notre Dame University and Georgetown, they have been given exemptions under the Affordable Care Act, saying we don't want to provide this kind of contraception because it violates our religious beliefs. How can the Obama administration say it has a compelling government interest in providing health care and birth control and, you know, give exemptions to some religious organizations and not to private religious corporations? And so that's the struggle that we're facing.
Now, I read today that there have been protesters outside the Supreme Court doors. What kinds of pressures are both sides facing as this unfolds?
Well, it's funny. Sandra Day O'Connor had a very famous quote way back when, saying that, you know, it was in the middle of the whole pro-choice, pro-life struggle over the abortion controversies in the early 80s. And she said, it makes a difference when you have 100,000 people outside your door. But, you know, certainly this court has already experienced some of this political controversy. Chief Justice John Roberts, when he came down in favor in supporting the Affordable Care Act, when he voted to uphold it, he left the country and went on vacation for 2 weeks because he knew there was going to be a firestorm associated with that decision. So, you know, we debate a lot whether the court is subject to public opinion. I think the harder issue for this court is how they are going to resolve the different doctrines relating to freedom of speech or freedom of religion, what the right standards ought to be, whether private corporations can have religious freedom. And looking back at the cases, you know, the case law that they have, they're going to have a really hard time reconciling the precedent. So I don't think they're going to be as worried about public opinion as they are trying to craft a rule of law that won't continue to cause further controversy and bring a whole bunch more claims. Because, you know, the implications of this are huge, not just for religion. Think about this most recent Arizona law where they, you know, Governor Brewer wound up vetoing the legislation, but there were a number of religious businesses for religious reasons which didn't want to serve the GLBT community. You can see the whole range of different issues that could be opened up as a result of allowing corporations to, lay a claim to religious freedom.
Kimmy, thank you so much for joining us and shedding some light on this.
All right. You take care and go Public Radio.
All right. Thanks a lot. That was Kimmy King, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Texas, with us to talk about the Supreme Court case on government-mandated contraception coverage.
It's time for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer.
Yesterday, President Obama announced that he is seeking to end bulk phone data collection. But how will Congress follow up on that proposal?
The Senate is in the midst of approving aid for Ukraine and authorizing sanctions against Russia. The U.S. government is concerned that Russia might not stop at Crimea.
And the enrollment period for health insurance through the government exchanges ends on Monday. Both Republicans and Democrats are eager to use whatever happens to bolster their cases in fall midterm elections, elections that popular statistics expert Nate Silver predicted this week might end with a Republican Senate.
Paul Singer joins us every Wednesday at this time to help make sense of everything Congress. Good to have you back, Paul.
Thanks. Good to be back with you.
So the White House, President Obama yesterday made some big news announcing that he wants to bring an end to the NSA's bulk phone data collection. I know some in Congress are trying to do something along the same lines. Is Congress going to be on board with what the president wants?
Probably not. I mean, I think they are on board with the general idea here is to get the government out of the business of collecting and holding large quantities of data. The question is how you do it. There are a couple competing legislative proposals already kicking around on Capitol Hill. I think some of the issues will be like, you know, how much permission does a judge have to give before some of this data can be opened by the FBI or other law enforcement? I think the questions become technical rather than ideological. Because I think everybody does want to end this bulk collection, but some of those technical problems can really trip up a bill.
Well, with a plan for the president, you mentioned two plans in Congress. It could be a bit of a muddle, I think is the technical term. Is anything going to come out the other side on this?
You know, I think it will. This is one of those topics where there is a great deal of public agreement that something should be done. There is a great deal of agreement in Congress and in the White House that the programs as currently constructed are a bad idea and wildly unpopular. I mean, I think this is something that everybody realizes their constituents hate, and so they're going to want to try and fix it somehow. And keep in mind, we might not actually end up seeing the details of it in public, because some of this is intelligence gathering stuff that may be done privately. It may be a confidential bill. I don't know.
So we'll know that something maybe has been done. We may not know exactly what.
That would not surprise me if they figure out some way to pass a bill that blurs over some of the details.
Huh. Well, also in the news, of course, Russia, Ukraine, Crimea, and Congress is working on this, looking at options for the U.S. Aid to Ukraine was stalled for a while. Has that been resolved?
It looks like it's been resolved. They were stalled over an argument over a Democratic proposal to restructure the International Monetary Fund. And this was attached to the Ukraine aid bill, and Republicans didn't want to get involved. It was going to probably be more money for the United States contributions to the IMF and less U.S. control, more control for other governments. The Republicans did not think this was a good idea and didn't think it was worth getting into it on the Ukraine bill. So they weren't going to allow the bill to move. And the Democrats finally conceded that, you know what, we're not going to hold up this bill any longer for this issue. So they dropped the issue. So now it's a clean, you would call it, Ukraine aid bill.
So they didn't need this IMF restructure to do what they wanted to do for Ukraine?
No. What they want to do for Ukraine is $150 million in cash, $1 billion in loan guarantees, and authorization for the president to pursue sanctions against Russia. The IMF stuff was the caboose on the train, and they could do without it.
President Obama has already been announcing sanctions on Russia. What does he need or want from Congress, and what are they doing?
Well, you know, the thing with the sanctions on Russia that we've thus far imposed are pretty piddling. It's sanctions against a bunch of individuals and their assets. They've attempted to sanction a couple of banks. But what Obama is really looking for is, first, the authority to go after broad sections of the Russian economy, like the energy sector, for instance. And second, I think more important even, is international agreement to enforce sanctions broadly. Sanctions that are imposed just by the U.S. are not going to be particularly influential if the Europeans are not playing along as well. So that's part of his European trip this week, has been all about that.
Turning to health insurance now, the Affordable Care Act, less than a week till the deadline to apply to enroll for health insurance through government exchanges. That's coming up Monday, though, a little wiggle room given by President Obama if people get stuck along the way. What kind of discussion are we hearing from people in Congress about that?
Well, you know, it depends what party you're in, right? as usual, Democrats, well, let me just back up. Our analysis at this point suggests that the administration is going to get somewhere around the 6 million enrollments they wanted by the end of March. They may not get to the 7 million they had originally thought they needed, but I think they're going to cross the 6 million threshold, which they will declare a victory. They'll say, look, it's now the law. It's the law of the land. The American people are engaged and enrolled, and it's good. Republicans are saying, here is the administration again changing a deadline, as you suggested. They moved the sort of last-minute deadline for a couple of weeks for some people, probably a very small group. Republicans are saying they're moving the deadlines, they're changing the law unilaterally, it's still a bad idea, it's going to cost people a lot more money, and let us run the Congress and we'll fix it. It's going to be their campaign theme for the rest of the year.
And speaking of campaigns, Nate Silver, the pollster who got a lot of attention in the run-up to the presidential race, and he predicted it pretty solidly. He said in his latest snapshot, the Republicans have a pretty solid chance of taking the Senate seats that they need to take control of the Senate. Democrats, not happy about that. What's been the reaction?
I mean, this is the stuff that drives me nuts. I could have told you yesterday that the Republicans had a good chance to take the Senate. We've been reporting on this stuff all year long, and there's a bunch of Senate races where the Democrats look weak, et cetera, et cetera. What Nate Silver does is he runs a bunch of numbers through a model, and he comes up with a sort of percentage result based on what we know today. And so what we know today is, surprise, surprise, it looks like Republicans are in a good place to take back the Senate. Yippee. The Democrats went bananas because they think that Nate Silver said it must be true. I think that the Democrats are attacking Nate Silver as a way of frightening their base into giving more money. Nate Silver says we're going to lose. You better give us more money. But this is all nonsense. I mean, we're 6 months away from an election. Who knows what's going to happen between now and then? All Nate Silver is doing is taking current existing polls that tell you exactly what you think they'd say, that the Democrats are in trouble and the Republicans are on the advantage. Great. Thanks, Nate.
Well, speaking of polls, you at USA Today released a poll recently about Americans' satisfaction with congressional politics. What did we learn from that?
Poll.
That was a really good one, huh?
Yeah, that one I liked. And it's interesting. I mean, the thing that we found that's most interesting is that Americans are sort of increasingly happy with a dysfunctional, divided Congress. They are saying basically that having strong partisan differences, one, prevents Congress from getting stuff done, which is okay because it stops dumb ideas from becoming law, and two, gives the voting public a real distinct choice between the Democrats and Republicans, and they like that.
And that's interesting. Well, Paul, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. We'll talk to you in a week.
That was Paul Singer. He's Congress and Politics Editor at USA Today. He joins us each Wednesday at this time to talk about the latest in politics. You can share your thoughts with us. Tweet us at CentralTimeWPR.
After Russ Feingold lost his re-election bid to Senator Ron Johnson in 2010, he put his work in the Foreign Relations Committee to work when Secretary of State John Kerry asked him to go to Africa.
Now, a U.S. special envoy to the Great Lakes region of Africa and the Democratic Republic of Congo, Feingold says his job is probably the most satisfying one he's ever had.
Our next guest caught up with him in Congo to talk about his diplomatic work in the region. Stuart Reed is a senior editor at Foreign Affairs magazine. He recently reported on his trip for Politico in a story called "Did Russ Feingold Just End a War?" Stuart, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, when he was a senator, Russ Feingold was mostly known for his work on campaign finance reform with Senator John McCain. And since his loss to Ron Johnson, we don't hear from him as much. We don't hear about him as much, at least here in Wisconsin. But it turns out he's been incredibly busy in Africa. Can you fill us in on what's been going on with him since he lost to Ron Johnson?
Sure. So after he lost in 2010, he went to Stanford Law School and wrote a book, and then in 2013, he got a call from John Kerry, his old buddy from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, asking him to become U.S. Special Envoy to the Democratic Republic of Congo in the Great Lakes region of Africa. And the main task for that position was to help end a long-running civil war in eastern Congo and handle the regional diplomacy and sort of elevate the conflict from the U.S. perspective above the individual ambassador level. So he took the position in July 2013 and then has been making lots of trips to the region and, as I argue, played a fairly significant role in helping bring at least some measure of peace to that region.
Well, and the thing is, unbeknownst to lots of people, Senator Feingold, or Russ Feingold, not a senator any longer, but he had amassed quite an expertise on Africa. How did that happen?
Right. So the way he tells it is when he won election in 1992, he joined the Senate in 93, he was told that as a junior senator from Wisconsin, he couldn't get the Judiciary Committee, he couldn't get appropriations, but he could get foreign relations. But because he was so junior, he was only able to get the Africa subcommittee. And so someone told him that he'd be, quote, stuck on the Africa subcommittee. So he ended up on that committee and ended up running it within not that long and sort of became a respected authority on Africa issues within the Senate and traveled to the continent on many congressional delegations and sort of almost by accident sort of became an expert on Africa.
Well, and as it turns out, the work has suited him well. He's told you that he finds it much more satisfying than his work in the U.S. Senate. Why is that?
Well, what he told me was in the Senate, there are a lot of maybes. So if you propose a bill, at first it has to get out of committee, you have to attract co-sponsors, it has to then get passed and then get not vetoed. So there are all these sort of steps, and there's a pretty big distance between, action and result. Whereas being a diplomat in Congo, he said there was much more immediacy. He was, walking, shuttling between government and rebel negotiators in this conflict and sort of making decisions on the fly and really, in the weeds and the diplomacy of it. And he just found that particularly satisfying. He also said that it was less politicized, that because Africa is certainly not at the top of the U.S. foreign policy agenda, there was a lot of leeway, and it wasn't a politicized issue. There isn't a Republican position on Congo versus a Democratic position. That sort of that lack of attention is actually helpful in a way.
Well, as you say, the struggle in the Democratic Republic of Congo, it hasn't been in the world's spotlight. Can you give us a brief history of the conflict going on there and what it's
Sure.
been, it's been unfolding?
So it traces back to 20 years ago, but to make a long story short, the eastern part of Congo has long been plagued by civil war, and various rebel groups have controlled territory and fought against the Congolese government. So in April 2012, the most recent group popped up. It was called the M23, and this is a group of rebels that wanted to overthrow the Congolese government, and they were actually backed by Congo's neighbor, Rwanda. So they were secretly receiving training and equipment and support from Rwanda, going across the border into Congo and attacking the military and taking over territory. So in April 2012, they started up, and things sort of got worse by the end of that year, and it became an international embarrassment because Congo has been home to the world's largest UN peacekeeping mission. And it was sort of an embarrassment that this rebel group could take so much territory right under the UN's nose. And so as I detail in my article, what ended up happening was the United States shifted its position towards Rwanda, Rwanda being the country that had been backing these rebels, and started putting more pressure on Rwanda, which had traditionally been a U.S. ally. Feingold comes in the summer of 2013, and they end up upping the pressure to the point that the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, ends up pulling support for this rebel group operating inside the neighboring Congo. And that group, the M23, ends up collapsing and sort of getting defeated within days.
And this was a complicated thing because the United States, it took a long time to get a cohesive position on how the United States was going to deal with Rwanda and Paul Kagame, because we had some interest in upholding him as a president of moral value and someone who was getting a lot of good work done. What happened to shift that position?
Sure. So there, as you say, there's sort of two sides to Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda. On the one hand, he's been incredibly effective at using aid money, and you know, his record on public health, on fighting corruption, all sorts of running a government things has been extraordinarily good, and his military is famously competent. However, on the other side of the coin, he's been secretly backing this rebel group called the M23, and also his country is not a bastion of democracy. It's a place where political dissidents get harassed and elections get stolen. So there was this sort of two sides of Kagame, and for a long time, the United States decided to ignore the dark side and basically support him as the best alternative there. But what ended up happening in late 2012 and over the course of 2013 was that the U.S. decided enough is enough and sort of pressured Kagame to knock it off.
And looking at Russ Feingold's role in all of this, you know, he had been a U.S. senator, and there's a lot of backroom wheedling that goes on in the Senate and in Congress in general. But as someone who functions more like a diplomat, it seems like you'd be looking more at qualities like subtlety and persuasion. So how did he make the jump to that sort of skill set?
Sure. So, I mean, as he puts it, in a lot of ways, it's not so different because there is a lot of persuasion that goes on in the Senate, and there is a lot of diplomacy and sort of, you know, creating coalitions and talking different sides. So I think he would, I can't speak for him, obviously, but I think he would say that there's less difference than you might think. And he also said that so he loves seeing the politicians in Congo because they remind him of himself, and he sort of sees his own behavior. And I think that was clear on the trip that, you know, when he knows how to work a room and has, you know, there were times when he'd be meeting with a group of local religious officials, and sort of you could picture him back in Wisconsin meeting with, you know, the firefighters union or whatever. There were a lot of parallels like that. So I think it's in a way it's not so different.
And so the title of your piece is, Did Russ Feingold Just End a War? What's the answer to that question?
Well, I think the answer is it's too soon to say because, I mean, first of all, this was, as Senator Feingold himself would admit, you know, an effort on the part of the U.S. government to change its position. It wasn't just him alone. And also there were other things that led to the collapse of this rebel group. The Congolese military sort of got actually better at fighting, so did the UN peacekeeping mission. So it wasn't just Russ Feingold. And it's also important to point out that even though this major rebel group has become a thing of the past, Eastern Congo is still not completely out of the woods yet. There are still other rebel groups. There still is the chance that a new one could pop up. That said, for the average person living in Eastern Congo, life has gotten significantly better since this group collapsed. So it's complicated. And as I make clear in the piece, one of the big challenges that still remains is getting the Congolese government to start acting like a government and you know, gaining control of its territory.
We're talking right now with Stuart Reed, senior editor at Foreign Affairs Magazine, about Russ Feingold's new career as special envoy to the Great Lakes region of Africa and the Democratic Republic of Congo. We're talking with Stuart Reed, senior editor at Foreign Affairs Magazine, about Russ Feingold's work as a U.S. diplomat in Africa's Great Lakes region and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Stuart is the author of a recent article in Politico magazine. It was called "Did Russ Feingold Just End a War?"
And you can join the conversation. As our guest mentioned, Africa is sometimes an afterthought in American foreign policy, in the media. Do you think that's a mistake? Should Africa be more front and center in our minds, in our foreign policy, in our media? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org.
And Stuart, in Davos recently, the work that had been happening in Congo got a shout out. I think it was from Kerry there, mm-hmm. talking about how, look, this is what we can accomplish sometimes when the spotlight isn't on and people are working conscientiously behind the scenes and it's not so pressurized. Is that something that you think Russ Feingold does deserve credit for, that he did accomplish quite a lot, even if you can't lay everything that happened at his doorstep? What does he deserve credit for?
Yeah, I mean, I think more broadly here, what the diplomatic effort of the U.S. government in Eastern Congo shows, I believe, is that you can accomplish quite a bit without you know, sending military contingents over there. This was a pretty cheap effort on the part of the U.S. government, right? They sent Russ Feingold there. They sort of withheld some aid, made some phone calls, and increased pressure on Rwanda, and it made a huge difference. It made a huge difference in getting this rebel group to lay down its arms. So I think what John Kerry would say and what Russ Feingold would say is, yeah, that U.S. power can still work. I mean, especially if you think of how hard it is to get what America wants in places like Ukraine or Syria. Here's an example of American power actually accomplishing something. Will it last forever? Who knows? Was it entirely the result of U.S. power? No. But I think you could make a case that it did make a difference here.
Let's go to the phones right now. We've got James joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, James.
Hi. Yes, I think it's a good thing that Russ is over there. The United States does need to focus more on what's going on in Africa in light of the fact that right now we're experiencing a scramble for African resources. China is all the way in there now, and the U.S. has to have some kind of a goodwill or develop a goodwill like it did it back in the 60s with the Peace Corps if they do want to have an influence on what's going to happen in the next 10 to 20 years.
Okay, interesting perspective. Thanks a lot, James. And what about Russ doing just that, spreading U.S. goodwill and involvement and demonstrating commitment to Africa?
Yeah, I mean, the caller pointed out China, and I think that's an interesting comparison, that one of the stories, a big story of Africa over the past decade or so has been the rise of Chinese involvement. And you see this in the Congo. You see the hotel we stayed in Kinshasa, the capital, was built by the Chinese in 2011 and had Chinese restaurant in it. So the influence is definitely there. And I think that may be one small motivating factor for or an argument you can make of why the U.S. should pay more attention to Africa, that because China is. And the way the two countries act is very different. I mean, the United States is sort of explicitly promoting democracy in China, democracy in Africa, whereas China is focused more, as the caller said, on resources.
Now, aside from the peace agreement he helped to broker between the M23 and the Congolese government, There are other pressing issues that are happening in Congo, including conservation issues. You went with him on a trek to see gorillas, and their numbers have plummeted from something like 17,000 to 5,000 over this period of civil unrest. It's also the rape capital of the world, apparently. How involved is Russ Feingold in issues like those?
I mean, I think what he would say is that they're all they all can be blamed on the same thing, which is the conflict itself, and that if you solve the conflict, then you will see improvements in the safety of women. You'll see improvements in environmental issues. While the guerrilla trek was sort of the day off there, it wasn't explicitly part of the diplomatic effort. I think there is an argument to be made that Eastern Congo has huge tourism potential. However, I think we're many, many years or decades at least away from that. And he did also visit a hospital that specializes in treating the survivors of rape. So he sees this as sort of, there are many different facets to this crisis, and he's going to try and be involved in as many as possible.
Now, you mentioned that sometimes when you can see him in Africa at work, you can just picture him back in Wisconsin doing his thing, being a consummate politician here, as he was for several years. And I wonder, because sometimes there's a sense in Wisconsin among, I suppose, especially Democrats, where is Russ Feingold? He never calls. He never writes.
I found him.
Where is he? And I wonder if he indicated to you whether Wisconsin's on his mind and he's intending to reengage himself in Wisconsin politics at any point.
Yeah, well, he never would, reveal his future plans of that. And he did say that usually for these special envoy jobs, you end up staying, around 2 or 3 years. And he started in July 2013. So I have no special insight into whether he'll, run for Senate again, which has been floated as an idea, or whether he'll be a vice presidential pick. I have no idea. But, he did talk frequently about Wisconsin and make comparisons. For instance, he talked about reintroducing elk in Wisconsin, how that had been a project that one could look to for inspiration of how to reintroduce gorillas into Congo.
You get the sense, I don't know, you don't say this explicitly in your article, but you do get the sense that he was happy to kind of shake off some of the dust of the partisan rancor in Washington and just kind of take a break and take a completely different track, but do work that he seems to think is just as meaningful, if not more meaningful.
Sure. I mean, I think he was particularly frustrated near the end of his career in the Senate by the Tea Party. He explained to me that he liked to hold town meetings in each of Wisconsin's counties. And what ended up happening near the end of his time in office was that they sort of got hijacked by the Tea Party and they would come and disrupt it. So I think he was a little, relieved in a way to leave all the partisanship behind. And I'm sure he, in 2010, would have preferred to have won. But yeah, as he said to me, this is one of his most favorite things that he's done in his life.
So he didn't reveal the future to you, what his intentions are, but could you see him pursuing a diplomatic track instead of entering the political fray again?
I don't know. I mean, I think this is sort of a one-off diplomatic posting that takes advantage of his sort of stature, his interest in Africa, and I'm not sure there, what other positions within the diplomatic world he could take on. I don't know. It's sort of anyone's guess. At least I don't have any special insight into that, I'd say.
Now, when he was a senator, Russ Feingold tried to warn the U.S. that parts of Africa were a safe haven for al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. Is that something that's still on his mind? Is it something he's trying to beat the drum about to this day?
Yeah, I mean, he's long had the argument that the United States should be paying more attention to Africa. In the case of Congo, you can't make the argument that this helps the fight against al-Qaeda. They're just not there, and there isn't really much of an Islamist presence, although in the north there are some groups. I think he's still making the case that Africa should be higher up on the agenda than it currently is. And I think part of the reason he's making that case is he's saying, look, you can actually achieve a lot here. This is the developing world, most of it, and the U.S. has influence and can be sort of a positive force here in a way that it's probably trickier to in other places.
Now, if I recall correctly, he's 61 years old?
Yes.
I don't know how that augurs for a continued political career at that age. Is it something you see as this is something he's taken on, and from here he moves on to other august but less political posts? Or is 61 still your prime when you're a politician?
He was putting in 12-hour days and said that, it was a little harder than when he was 40 years old, but it was still, I was exhausted at the end of the day just sitting there taking notes, so I can't imagine how tiring it must have been to to actually be, you know, the center of attention and working a room and speaking. So, you know, he seemed in good health and lively, and I'm not sure that 61 is that old for a politician.
And did you tell him lots of folks in Wisconsin were thinking about him?
I think he gets that sense, although he did say that when he took the job to be special envoy to the Great Lakes region of Africa, someone in Wisconsin asked him, "Oh, does that mean you're going to be out in Lake Erie measuring water levels with a stick?" So he had to sort of explain his role that there's another Great Lakes to some Wisconsinites.
Did you get the sense that he wanted to do more in this vein as he got through this position in Africa that you say could last a couple, 2 to 3 years? Were these accomplishments enough, do you think, to keep him moving in that direction?
It's hard to say. I mean, again, these roles as special envoy, the idea is that, you know, relations will return to a normal point where the United States won't need to have a special envoy, and it can just treat it like any other, you know, healthy region where there are ambassadors. However, that probably won't be the case anytime soon. I mean, there's still a lot of challenges that remain in the region, but I think he's, you know, I can't speak for him, but it would surprise me if he suddenly lost interest in Africa.
Stuart, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this today.
Well, thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Stuart Reed, senior editor at Foreign Affairs Magazine, talking about Russ Feingold's diplomatic work as a special envoy to Africa.